content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled When the South Awakened by Andrew Lawler. How a disagreement with a Scottish lord helped kickstart the American Revolution. Everyone knows how the Redcoats clashed with patriots at Lexington and Concord in April 1775, sparking the American Revolution. Yet often forgotten is an incident that took place 2 days later and some 500 miles to the south, an event that proved nearly as significant to the cause of independence as the bloodshed in Massachusetts. It was the moment when the South was finally roused against the British, and its main participants were some of the nation's most famous founders. It began after Patrick Henry convinced the conservative tobacco planters of Virginia, the largest, most populous, and richest of the 13 colonies, to organize a militia. The decision put Virginia's royal governor, Lord Dunmore, in a bind. Appointed by George III in 1771, the gregarious Scottish earl had purchased plantations, fought enslaved Africans, and schemed with his friend, a gentleman farmer named George Washington, to obtain vast tracts of indigenous land in the distant Ohio Valley. Among Dunmore's neighbors in the capital of Williamsburg was Peyton Randolph, then serving as the first president of the Continental Congress. As patriots thrilled to Henry's stirring words, "Give me liberty or give me death," and agreed to form a militia, London was buzzing with news that New Englanders had seized cannon and gunpowder from a British fort. Dunmore decided to remove the ammunition kept in Williamsburg's powder magazine, a whimsical octagonal building in the town's market square. The patriots posted sentries to guard the colony's arsenal. Dunmore, in turn, had his own spies watching the watchers. In the early hours of April 21st, 1775, gale force winds whipped across the town square, driving the shivering sentries from their posts to the shelter of their beds. Dunmore's informants quickly reported the guard's absence and roused him from sleep at the nearby governor's palace. The earl scribbled a note in the candlelight and sent a messenger to deliver the letter and the magazine key to the captain of a Royal Navy ship anchored a half dozen miles away in the James River. About 3 o'clock that morning, under a waning moon, a wagon carrying 20 Royal Navy Marines and sailors trundled into the sleeping capital. The blustering winds muffled the clank of wheels and thud of hooves. Dismounting, the ship's captain unlocked the outer gate, and his men scurried into the courtyard, squeezing through the small door that led to the gunpowder room. The men stacked 15 half-barrels, each weighing about 65 pounds, in the wagon. By the time some early risers spotted the intruders and sounded the alarm, it was too late. The precious cargo was soon rolling toward the James River in the safety of the ship's hold. The alarm awakened William Pasteur, a London-trained surgeon who served on the town council and was sympathetic to the patriot cause. He pulled on his breeches and waistcoat and rushed into the street amid a great commotion. Most of the city's white male inhabitants were out in force, he recalled, many of them under arms. Dunmore later said an angry crowd had gathered on the green in front of the stately palace, making continual threats to my house. He was sure they intended to seize upon or massacre me, and every person found giving me assistance if I refused to deliver the power immediately into their custody. Randolph and other town leaders quieted the furious mob, knocked on the palace door, and humbly presented Dunmore with a petition asking that the gunpowder be returned. The governor argued that he had removed the ammunition because of intelligence that enslaved Africans, who made up nearly half of the colony's residents, planned to seize the powder to launch an insurrection. His goal, he claimed, had been to protect the colonists, not to disarm them. Given recent rumors that those in bondage intended to rebel, the delegation accepted his explanation, withdrew, and convinced the waiting crowd outside to disperse. The crisis seemed to have passed. Dunmore's suspicion of the colonists, on the other hand, had not. The next morning, he told Pasteur that two of his officers had been threatened by town residents the previous day and swore that if any injury befell them or his family, he would declare freedom to the slaves and reduce the city of Williamsburg to ashes. With no British troops on hand, Dunmore saw this threat as his only option to avert violence. Yet the move only incensed white colonists throughout the colonies. One angry Virginian accused Dunmore of stirring up the Negroes to a rebellion, while a Charleston newspaper fulminated over the monstrous absurdity that the governor can deprive the people of the necessary means of defense against their human chattel. As news of the affair spread, hundreds of Patriot militia members gathered in Fredericksburg, a tobacco port typically 2 days' ride north of the capital, to show zeal in the grand cause by marching to Williamsburg. They sent an urgent letter to George Washington, asking for his blessing as well as men and ammunition to launch their assault. Yet the man, recognized as the foremost military expert in the colony, never responded to repeated messages from the Fredericksburg militia. During what was arguably the most consequential month in American history, Washington remained silent at Mount Vernon. That reticence had to do with real estate. To avoid an expensive war with Native Americans, Britain had forbidden colonists from claiming tribal lands on the west side of the Appalachian Mountains. Members of Virginia's gentry chafed at this ban, and Washington had spent years lobbying Dunmore to use his influence to reverse this restriction. In April 1775, he was still pleading his case. An attack on Williamsburg and his patron would be sure to derail his dreams of greater wealth in the West. When Dunmore learned of the Patriot March, he reiterated his threat to free and arm enslaved Virginians. Randolph, president of the Continental Congress, faced the prospect of war breaking out virtually on his doorstep. He sent a letter to Fredericksburg fudging the truth, insisting that the governor had promised that the powder shall be returned to the magazine, though he has not condescended to fix the day for its return. He urged the militia to stand down, warning that violent measures may produce effects which God only knows the consequence of. Just before Randolph's letter arrived, a dispatch about the Massachusetts battles had reached the militia encampment. Emboldened by the news from Lexington and Concord, the assembled officers were eagerly preparing for the offensive. They read Randolph's letter aloud, and only after a stormy debate did they grudgingly agree to disperse the troops to avert the horrors of a civil war. What was for Randolph a crisis to defuse and Washington one to avoid was for Patrick Henry an opportunity. A country lawyer saw a chance to engage Virginia's small farmers and tenants, most of whom remained loyal to the king and largely indifferent to tensions with Britain. Unlike their New England counterparts, these men had not suffered from the presence of British troops, cared little about tariffs, and preferred cider to tea. But they did care about their muskets, rifles, and gunpowder. "You may in vain mention to the duties to the people upon tea, etc.," Henry explained to a friend that month. "These things will not affect them. They depend on principles too abstracted for their apprehension and feeling. But tell them of the robbery of the magazine, and that the step will be to disarm them," he added. "You bring the subject home to their bosoms, and they will be ready to fly to arms to defend themselves." Henry's claim that the British intended to seize weapons owned by Virginians was patently false, but it proved effective, and the idea swept the colony. Dunmore, another patriot, reported, "designed by disarming the people to weaken the means of opposing an insurrection of the slaves, a constant paranoia. Guns were essential for white owners to control the enslaved population, and white Virginians feared such an uprising more than a British invasion. The powder incident gave Henry the means to energize previously uncommitted colonists." A few days after the militia in Fredericksburg had disbanded, Henry assembled his own army and gave a rousing speech. The famed orator, one biographer reports, showed them that the recent plunder of the magazine in Williamsburg was nothing more than a part of the general system of subjugation. On the fine spring morning of May 3rd, Henry led more than 100 armed men singing patriotic songs on the road to Williamsburg, halting that evening only 16 miles shy of the capital. A panicked Dunmore, with little time to muster a defense, sent a delegate to negotiate a deal. If Henry's men would depart, the governor would pay for the powder impounded on the warship. After tense talks that lasted until nearly dawn, Henry agreed to the compromise and wrote a note declaring that the powder affair was now settled. He mounted his horse and headed to Philadelphia to join Randolph in Washington for the Second Continental Congress. But the incident was far from over. Dunmore's threat to emancipate enslaved Africans twice kept the rebels at bay. But in June, amid fears of kidnapping or assassination plot, he fled Williamsburg, later settling in the coastal port of Norfolk. In late October, as hundreds of enslaved people flocked to British lines for refuge, Henry's Patriot Army marched on Norfolk. An outnumbered Dunmore published the continent's first Emancipation Proclamation, granting freedom for those enslaved by patriots. Those freedom would then fight for the king. Lacking British troops to defend his position, he gave the freed men guns and training and sent them into battle, sometimes against their former owners. After Dunmore's proclamation, even his erstwhile friend Washington, now in charge of the Continental Army, lost some of his enslaved workers to Dunmore's camp. He railed against the governor as that arch traitor to the rights of humanity. Meanwhile, frightened Southern planters, those reluctant revolutionaries, threw in with their radical New England cousins. By May 1776, Virginia's Patriot leaders voted unanimously to separate from Britain and urged the Continental Congress to do the same. That key decision broke the deadlock among the squabbling colonies, paving the way for the adoption of Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. Soon after, Dunmore and his multiracial troops were driven from Virginia, but his decision to arm men of color forced Washington to accept freedmen into the Continental Army, where they fought for American liberty until the final battle at Yorktown. And nearly a century later, the decree published by Washington's nemesis would serve as the model for a more famous document, President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. Next, we'll move on to an article titled French Gunpowder, American Grit by Mike Riggs, how a stalwart ally's mastery of chemistry helped win the Revolutionary War. Shortly after taking command of the Continental Army in July 1775, General George Washington ordered an accounting of the Patriots' gunpowder stores. What he learned the total available was a measly 90 barrels. An eyewitness claimed Washington did not utter a word for half an hour. Things were not much better by January 1776, when Washington wrote a letter to a trusted officer bemoaning the lack of supplies. "We are now without any money in our treasury, powder in our magazines, arms in our stores." But help was on the way. In March 1776, Congress's Committee of Secret Correspondence dispatched Connecticut politician and merchant Silas Deane on a mission to France, where he covertly met with Pierre-Augustin Caron de Beaumarchais, a confidant of Louis XVI. Beaumarchais, who described himself in a letter to Congress as an ardent supporter of the American rebels, established a front organization, Roderie Courtelet and Company, to smuggle French, Dutch, and Spanish guns, clothing, and other supplies to the colonists, directly and via the West Indies. He also provisioned Washington's troops with gunpowder made by Antoine Lavoisier, France's gunpowder guru. In 1775, Lavoisier had assumed control of France's national gunpowder production. Considered the founder of the chemical revolution, he brought exacting standards and new refining techniques to what had previously been a simple but inexact process of mixing three simple ingredients. After extensive tests, Lavoisier eventually settled on a ratio of 75% saltpeter, 12.5% charcoal, and 12.5% sulfur. He later declared the resulting French gunpowder the best in Europe. More important than its quality was its availability. The colonies lacked the industrial capacity to make powder and guns, so they didn't need the best. They just needed any at all. Thanks to Beaumarchais and other sympathizers, they got them. By the end of 1777, France had smuggled roughly 2 million pounds of gunpowder and 60,000 French arms into the colonies, roughly one for every soldier in the Continental Army. These shipments led to the American victory at Saratoga in October 1777, a decisive moment for independence. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Queen of the Air by Victor Luckerson, Long before the Tuskegee Airmen, Bessie Coleman inspired a generation of black pilots to take to the skies. It felt like a homecoming. Thousands of onlookers cheered wildly as daredevil pilot Bessie Coleman arced her Curtis Jenny biplane into a spiral above a Houston field. The weather was scorching, but Coleman kept her cool as she cruised through loop-de-loops and gunned across the blue skies at 75 miles per hour. The aviator was already a colossal figure to many in the audience. In recent years, her globe-trotting escapades had taken her to Los Angeles, Chicago, Paris, Amsterdam, and beyond. The Chicago Defender had declared her the quote-unquote queen of the air. Now back home in Texas, on June 19, 1925, she was finally achieving her true aerial ambitions as a main attraction in the first ever all-black air show in the state, and doing it on Juneteenth, no less. "I'm a native Texan," she told a newspaper reporter, "and proud that a Texan is the only Negro aviatrix in the world." While the Tuskegee Airmen have become icons in the history of American aviation, fewer people know the story of Bessie Coleman, the black pilot who charted a course for them and many others in the 1920s. Known as Brave Bessie or Queen Bess, Coleman boasted a fearlessness that made her a perfect fit for a Juneteenth celebration. The holiday got its start in Galveston, Texas on June 19, 1865, when enslaved African Americans learned of their freedom following the Civil War. Coleman, herself born to sharecropper parents in slavery's shadow, took that promise of freedom airborne. The Juneteenth show in Texas was the culmination of an unlikely rise, literally to the clouds, for a black woman whose courage still astounds a century later. Coleman was born in 1892 in Atlanta, Texas, and moved to the town of Waxahachie when she was a toddler, according to her biographer Doris L. Rich. Her father, who was part Native American, left the family for Oklahoma when Bessie was young. Money was tight and education was hard to come by. Coleman picked cotton for months each year. After the eighth grade, she worked as a washerwoman and watched over her younger sisters. Still, she yearned for more. When her older brother invited her to come live with him on Chicago's South Side, she leapt at the chance. She went to beauty school in the city and soon became a manicurist. Pretty and quick-witted, Coleman preferred to work at barber shops, where she would charm male customers for generous tips and provide manicures to proud patrons in the front window. She also befriended Robert Abbott, the founder and publisher of the Chicago Defender, the nation's leading black newspaper, who would become a valued mentor. A Defender news item in 1918 praised her as a shining example of a progressive, up-to-date young woman. But Coleman was not content to be a window prize. One day, her older brother John, a World War I veteran, came into the barbershop and proclaimed that black women would never be able to fly airplanes. Coleman took the insult as a challenge and soon began researching where she could pursue training. She found that no white pilots in the area were willing to teach her. Military training was also a non-starter, since the U.S. Army Air Service, a forerunner to the Air Force, did not accept women. So Coleman expanded her vision. She began studying French and saving money for a passage to Europe, where women pilots were not so disdained. Abbott, reportedly keen to mine black success stories to help sell newspapers, urged her on and even provided financial backing. On November 20, 1920, at the age of 28, Coleman embarked on the SS Imperator for France. She would train at the École d'Aviation des Frères Cadrons at Le Creteuil, one of France's most prestigious flight schools. Coleman spent 7 months learning loop-de-loops and banking turns in Newport 82, a French biplane used for training. The planes were rickety contraptions with no brakes that belched castor oil and had to be dragged to a stop with a tail skid after a landing. Every pilot knew how dangerous flying was, and Coleman watched herself watched a classmate die in an accident while training in France. But she was determined to prove that she, and people who looked like her, could conquer this new frontier. "I thought it my duty to risk my life to learn aviating and to encourage flying among men and women of the race," she said. "I made up my mind to try. I tried and was successful." In June 1921, Coleman received her license from the renowned Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, becoming the first black woman to earn that distinction. The license granted her the ability to fly anywhere in the world. Word of Coleman's unusual achievement soon reached the States. When she returned to America in September 1921, she became a full-blown celebrity. A gaggle of reporters awaited her arrival in New York on the SS Manchuria. A series of profiles in the Chicago Defender soon followed. When she attended a popular Broadway musical in Manhattan, the cast presented Coleman with an engraved silver cup, and the multiracial but segregated audience gave her a standing ovation. Still, Coleman remained focused on her craft. Soon she was back in Europe, gaining more aerial training from leading aircraft experts in Amsterdam and Berlin. In the late summer of 1922, when she again returned to the States, she began conducting flying circuses in New York and Chicago and at various state fairs. Thousands of fans attended the events, which often cost between a quarter and 75 cents per head, around $14 today, and sometimes included a chance for attendees to go airborne themselves with Coleman piloting. Her stylish clothes enhanced her showmanship. Her typical uniform was custom leather coat, shiny boots, and a leather helmet and goggles. Coleman took responsibility as a black role model seriously. She hoped to launch a flight school to train black pilots, especially women. She refused to perform for whites-only audiences, and while her shows often had a segregated seating, she wouldn't allow venues to force her black fans to come in through a separate entrance. A movie in which she was set to star fell apart when she got hold of the script and saw she be portraying an ignorant, poverty-stricken black woman. "No Uncle Tom stuff for me," she told the film's manager as she walked out on her contract. But even with a glamour of celebrity, making a living was a constant challenge. As a member of an ensemble in her early aerial shows, she rarely raked in major profits. Planes were expensive, so she typically borrowed one from a local pilot for her shows. When she finally purchased her own plane in 1923, she crashed it in California on the way to a performance. The accident put her in the hospital for 3 months with fractured ribs and a broken leg. From her hospital bed, she insisted her career wasn't over. "Tell them all, as soon as I can walk, I'm going to fly," she wrote in a telegram to her well-wishers. After her injury, Coleman struggled to book gigs and cycled through a series of dubious managers. In Texas, though, things finally started to turn back around. She found fresh income by lecturing on her European exploits, which only boosted fans' eagerness to see her take to the skies. The Juneteenth 1925 festivities cemented her comeback. When Coleman returned to the ground, one reporter observed more than a dozen pairs of hands were outstretched to help her from the machine. For the rest of the summer, Coleman toured around Texas, even performing in Waxahachie, the town where she'd grown up. At one show, she did a wing walk, stepping out onto the wing of the plane while airborne and leaping down into the crowd via parachute. She was invited to meet with Miriam Ferguson, the state's first woman governor, at the Texas governor's mansion. Coleman was planning to transition away from daredevil stunts and towards speaking and building her flight school for black pilots. Less than a year later, however, tragedy struck. In April 1926, Coleman and another pilot named William Wells were conducting an aerial survey of an airfield in Jacksonville, Florida, where Coleman was prepping for her next show. At about 3,500 feet, Willis lost control of the plane and the aircraft flipped upside down. Coleman fell out of her seat and plummeted to her death. Willis died when the plane crashed into a nearby farm. Investigators later found that a wrench had jammed the plane's controls. Rumors swirled that someone had sabotaged Coleman, but no further evidence of foul play ever emerged. Freak accidents were unfortunately common in the early days of aviation. Coleman's death had the weight of a national tragedy, at least in Black America. More than 5,000 people attended her memorial service in Jacksonville. In Chicago, where Coleman had first pursued her dream of becoming a pilot, 10,000 mourners honored her coffin ahead of a funeral at Pilgrim Baptist Church. Congressman Oscar DePriest and civil rights activist Ida B. Wells participated in the homegoing ceremonies. The Defender published several obituaries, mournful but proud. Coleman's eyes, one article reflected, were always fixed on the stars. Coleman was just 34 when she died, never achieving her lifelong dream of training a new generation of black pilots. But her legacy as an aviator would touch many lives. Just 3 years after her death, a Los Angeles-based pilot and aviation entrepreneur named William Powell formed a flight school called the Bessie Coleman Aero Club. Among the group's members was James Banning, who in 1932 made history with Thomas C. Allen, becoming the first black pilots to conduct a transcontinental flight. In 1934, when Powell published a book about his own aerial exploits, he dedicated it to Coleman, who had displayed courage equal to those of the most daring men. Over the ensuing decades, Coleman's legend quietly grew. When astronaut Mae Jemison became the first African-American woman to travel to space, she carried a photograph of Coleman with her. Coleman also inspired Jesse L. Brown, the first African-American pilot to complete Navy flight training. And this summer, Coleman will be featured in the renewed Pioneers of Flight Gallery at the newly renovated Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, celebrating her role as a groundbreaking aviator and a thrilling barnstormer. Did you know you have never lived until you've flown, she mused once? Of course, it takes one with courage, nerve, and ambition. Next, we'll move on to Soaring Ambitions by Sonia Anderson. The teenage parachuting pioneer Georgia Tiny Broadwick showed that courage isn't counted in pounds. In 1908, a 15-year-old girl named Georgia Tiny Broadwick leapt from a hot air balloon and floated more than 1,000 feet down to earth under a parachute. It was the start of a prolific aerial career. The 4'8", 85-pound Broadwick went on a jump from the sky some 900 times, demonstrate skydiving for the U.S. Army, and inspire an invention that changed parachuting. Born in 1893, the North Carolinian spent her youth working in a cotton mill, got married at 12 years old, and was abandoned by her husband shortly thereafter. When she was 15, she watched the parachuter Charles Broadwick jump from a lofted balloon at a carnival. Hooked, Broadwick convinced him to teach her his act, after which she took his name. At a carnival in Raleigh in 1908, Broadwick performed her first public jump. Soon, spectators were lining up to see her fly. Soon, Broadwick became the first woman to parachute from an airplane. In one early jump, on January 9, 1914, she sat in a swing that hung from a plane 2,000 feet above Los Angeles, pulled a lever, and dropped. She floated safely into Griffith Park. Later that year, Broadwick was demonstrating parachuting for soldiers in San Diego when she encountered a pivotal snag. Her parachute's static line was catching on the aircraft, so she cut it. Free-falling, Broadwick maneuvered her lines to open the parachute. Her snip is often credited as the first use of a ripcord, later patented by Floyd Smith. Growing up in poverty, Broadwick showed working people that the wonders of aviation were only for wealthy men. Her skill and courage proved that aviation is classless. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.